On today's Emerging Tech Horizons, we look at the National Defense Industrial Strategy. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. I'm Arun Serafin, Executive Director of NDIA's Emerging Technologies Institute. Today's episode, we're going to look at the newly released National Defense Industrial Strategy. According to DoD, the National Defense Industrial Strategy offers a strategic vision to coordinate and prioritize actions to build a modern defense industrial ecosystem that is fully aligned with the National Defense Strategy. It also calls for a sustained collaboration and cooperation between the entire U.S. government, private industry, and our allies and partners abroad. The NDIS postures our industrial ecosystem to provide our warfighters the necessary capabilities they need at speed and scale. To help us delve deeper into this topic, we're honored to welcome our special guest on the show today, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International and Industrial Engagement, Justin McFarland. Thanks for being with us, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
Justin works for Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment Bill LaPlante and Assistant Secretary of Defense for Industrial-Based Policy Laura Taylor-Calais. Mr. McFarland is responsible for the Defense Industrial-Based Engagement Strategy Development and Coordination, and he's got a major focus on international armaments cooperation. Comes to this role after 20 years of working in defense industry, including with L3Harris. That was after his distinguished career as an Army officer, including as a Patriot Missile Battery platoon leader and service in Iraq. And this all after earning science, business, and public administration degrees from West Point, Dartmouth, and Harvard. I've heard of all of those places. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I got the student loans to prove it.
Okay, so. Great. So please welcome me in welcoming Justin in today's podcast. So thanks for being here. And I tried to do a little bit on your extensive background in government and industry, but could you share how you got to the position that you have today?
Yeah, I will. And thanks again for having me. This is just a delight for me to be here and talk about NDIS and some of the work that we're doing. As far as how I got to this role, it was really just an exciting opportunity. I've spent the bulk of my career, as you mentioned, more outside of government, but I've always envisioned myself straddling the two, public and private sector, specifically around the defense industry. So as you mentioned, started my career on the public side, you know, as a uniformed officer, but then transitioned over to the private sector. Where I spent a large number of years working on a lot of the kind of hard issues that the defense industry and senior leaders within the defense kind of ecosystem are faced with. And so this really came about when this position was created. It was really just the culmination of all of my experiences, kind of all rolled into one place. Some of the international work that I did when I was in the Army, a lot of the industry experience that I had, and really just kind of the bringing of the two together in this role. It almost seemed like it was made for me, but it wasn't. So I was very excited when the White House reached out and asked me to interview, and that went well, obviously, and so here I am.
That's great. That's great. And you know, we're grateful to have all your experience, both wearing uniform, the industry side, and now the civilian side, and mixing all those experiences together is, I think, what we need.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, so I know we're talking about the NDIS, and I think that that experience really helps to shape, you know, at least my perspective in you know, how I tackled some of the development of the content, as well as how we're thinking of the implementation and the operations of it. Because I was able to, through my experience, look at a lot of these problems from different angles and different lenses.
Different perspectives.
Looking at it from an operational perspective as a warfighter, looking at it from a business perspective, having spent time in the private sector, but then also being able to look at it from the government perspective in my current role.
So you are the first ASD for international industry engagement.
First of my
name. Can you tell us what that means? What are your roles? What are your responsibilities? And what are your top priorities right now?
Sure. So I manage two offices. One is the Office of Industry Engagement. Pretty much a brand new office. It's actually really exciting because it's almost like having a startup within DoD. So that office is really focused on being the bridge maker and bridge builder. Not just between ANS and the Pentagon and industry, but then also the inverse and making sure that we're able to route issues to the right offices within the Pentagon, ensure that industry stakeholders are able to get access and the right information to make leadership decisions that they need, and things of that nature, supporting all of the industry engagements that our senior leaders have within the Pentagon. Is really kind of their mandate. Then the other office that I manage is the Office of International Cooperation. So as you mentioned, a lot of the arms cooperation, all the international agreements that the department has with our allies and partners, kind of get routed through that office. And so it's about 25-ish countries where we manage bilateral relationships. Then in addition, a number of multilateral relationships that we manage, such as NATO and EU, NTIB come to mind. And as far as the priorities go, the things that I'm really focused on, you know, number one, as I mentioned, brand new office, brand new role, really standing up the organization. Over the past year and change, hiring on the leadership teams, especially on the industry side, and just making sure that, planning for budget and resources, and real estate, all the things that you would think of.
Learning the Pentagon bureaucracy, those sorts of things you have to do.
And then I'd say that the other priorities are really tied to, either the current conflicts or where we think that there's potential for conflict in the future. So Ukraine and Taiwan, support to Taiwan, are two big priorities. And I'd say the third, that international bucket, is AUKUS. Very, very heavily involved.
And that's the cooperation with Australia,
correct,
UK.
Correct. And so there's the called Pillar One, which is the provision of nuclear-powered, conventionally armed submarines to Australia. But then Pillar Two, which I think is kind of the cooler part, is collaborating around advanced technologies. And we're really focused on working together with our allies, in that case, specifically Australia and the UK, around co-development, co-production, and co-sustainment of kind of advanced technologies to deliver capabilities to all of our warfighters.
Yeah, we appreciate all your work. And I know you've already done some work with NDIA and some of our events and conferences. We look forward to doing that in the future. So today, we want to dive into the National Defense Industrial Strategy. So in January, DoD released its first ever National Defense Industrial Strategy. Can you describe for the listeners the origin and the goals of the strategy? Why release it now?
Yeah. And I think if we were to go all the way back to the end of the Cold War, people talk about the Last Supper and the consolidation of the defense industry that transpired with that peace dividend. Consistent investments in the industrial base basically kind of disappeared at that point. Even if you were to look at the time period from 85 to 2021, including Iraq and Afghanistan, Department of Defense's budget as a percentage of GDP shrunk. It went from roughly 5.5 to 6% down to a little bit over 3% over that time period. And so that investment, or lack of investment rather, also coincides with contractions in companies, consolidation, and reduction of workforce, as well as a number of companies leaving the industrial base and not choosing not to provide services or capabilities or products to the department.
Because as the size of the spend goes down, naturally,
exactly.
the industrial base that supports,
yeah. right. Yeah.
And actually your touch on the economy gets less and less.
Yeah, too, right? Exactly. So I think COVID really highlighted to a lot of senior leaders some of the challenges that we were facing around supply chain and workforce and things of that nature. But COVID didn't start any of this. A lot of this predates that. And so coming out of COVID and coinciding with the conflict in Ukraine, I think all of us realized the impact of the lack of investments and that something really needed to happen. And so the department's most senior leaders, Secretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary of Defense, directed and guided the development of the NDIS to ensure that we are re-energizing U.S. manufacturing and building up that industrial base to ensure that our warfighters have the capabilities they need, not just to continue supporting our partners and allies in any type of current conflicts, but then also looking ahead at any type of future engagements that we might have.
So at the top level, considering NDI members are big companies, medium mm-hmm. companies, small companies, even universities and government
yep.
organizations, what are the key findings that you would have them take away at the top level?
Yeah, and so there's four strategic priorities laid out in NDIS. I know we're short on time, so we're not going to go deep into all of them, but there's a couple that I'll highlight here, and one is really supply chain. A lot of the issues, and we've seen it not just on the defense side, but then also on the commercial side as well, the challenges with supply chain. And a lot of times it's not the prime contractor or the person that's integrating all of the components, but it's down in the sub tiers. It's the mom and pop shops. It's the small businesses. And so, you know, figuring out ways to tackle that issue from a number of lenses and ensuring supply chain resilience is one of the big priorities within the NDIS. Another big priority is workforce, as I mentioned. You know, with the contraction of the industrial base, with companies choosing potentially to exit from the market, there's workforce challenges in trying to ramp that back up again. And identifying the people that have the right skill sets. I think we're also competing against other industries. And so if someone has the option of, oh, I can work in a shipyard that's dirty, smelly, maybe a little bit dangerous, or I can work as a UPS driver or somewhere else and make a similar money, what are they going to choose?
Right.
So I think workforce is another area.
And when you think about industrial-based workforce, I mean, there's hardly a job that doesn't fit, right?
Yeah.
It's everything. It's it's the folks doing the skilled trades kind of things, the machinists, and it's the computer people. It's the
software developers.
It's the PhDs in whatever field and everyone in between. And that's your workforce.
Yeah, I mean, like take AI, for example.
Right.
I mean, yes, there's definitely, a strong need for specialists and experts and software developers to focus on AI within the defense context. But at the same time, you're competing for that same talent with, the Facebooks or the ChatGPTs or Microsoft or other companies on the commercial side that are doing this for commercial purposes. And we'll probably pay a lot more.
right. And we can go deeper into workforce.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
One of the things on the workforce side that's interesting is that, one is there are these commercial opportunities. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that sometimes some of these jobs require clearances.
Mm-hmm.
And so that further limits the pool of talent that you can go after.
Well, it does. And, clearances come with restrictions and some folks don't necessarily want to, box themselves into that.
Right.
And so it does pose challenges, definitely.
All right. So we've covered two of them. What are the other couple of high level
areas? Yeah. So the other two, we can touch on economic deterrence. So really ensuring that we're, understanding how strategic economic competitiveness and economic factors such as, investment, how that plays into any type of deterrent effect with any type of adversaries. And the fourth is flexible acquisition. And in some ways, I'm not going to say it's a catch-all. We actually had to name something different.
The dreaded acquisition reform.
Well, so that's why I was going to caveat it a little bit. Because we had it named something different before, but we realized that previous name wasn't quite accurate and didn't encapsulate all the things that we were considering. So I wouldn't say that we're looking at acquisition reform, because I know that's been tackled a number of times from a number of different angles, but it's other areas kind of within acquisition and the acquisition apparatus where I think that there's some levers that we can pull or need to pull, rather.
Right, and are probably going to have to make use of what kinds of things you can do already in contracting and working with industry, especially if you want to engage this new kind of commercial.
Exactly. So, so things like COTS, how do we more effectively and efficiently use commercial off the shelf technology? How do we educate our acquisition workforce on the benefits of commercial of COTS capabilities? How do we, let them know that, it's good, it's okay for it to be COTS. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's, not as capable as something that's, built to purpose. So things like that fall into the flexible acquisition piece.
Okay, so let's dive in a little on the resilient supply chain. So supply chains is an area that ETI has done a lot of work on in the past few years, especially focusing on supply chains for emerging technologies and systems like hypersonics, directed energy. Common thing that we've heard is that a negative impact on building the supply chain is a lack of consistent government demand signals.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that limits your ability to understand what kind of investments to make, what kind of hiring to do. How does the NDS try to go after that issue of demand?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing, it actually somewhat predates the NDIS, but it's something that we're trying to figure out where it's appropriate to expand, is the use of multi-year procurement authorities. So we put that in place and are using that for munitions to, as you said, provide that steady demand signal, because historically munitions has been a bill payer. You know, every year, you know, people are like, oh, well, we need an extra $100 million here, so why don't we just buy, you know, a few less of these rounds or a few less of these missiles. And so being able to provide that consistent demand to industry to say, yes, we are going to buy this same amount or this amount every year, allows them to make the investments that we are asking them to make, to expand production and to, you know, increase their capacity.
Right. Yeah, because it seems like an easy dial to turn when you're trying to make the budget fit.
Yeah, and as a result,
I don't always think about the impact.
The sine wave, you know, I know from my experience outside of the building and, you know, the conversations that I've had since I've been in, the sine wave of funding causes a lot of angst. Yeah.
So what other steps do you talk about in the NDIS for the more resilient supply chain?
I think other things that we're really looking at is the illumination, the data, understanding where there's gaps. And it's not just gaps, you know, U.S.-wise. You know, as I mentioned, I work a lot with partners and allies. So thinking about this from a global perspective, you know, where are there U.S. gaps? Where are there partner and ally gaps? And then how can we fill those either with, you know, some of their capabilities or some of our, fill their gaps with our capabilities?
Right.
You know, one of the things
just
that,
understanding illumination.
Just understanding the problem is the first, you know,
right,
the first step.
Where it's coming from,
and it's a big challenge because you know, the data. I'm a data guy, and so getting the data is hard because, as I mentioned, it's not at the prime level where a lot of the challenges occur. It's at the sub tier level. So how do you get the information on the subcontracts and the third and fourth level suppliers? That's not something that DoD necessarily always has on hand. And we have to work with the primes and work with industry to really get that data, understand it, and then take action based upon it.
So let's talk about economic deterrence. That was one of the other pillars.
Yeah.
So close partners and allies that you work on play a role in lots of parts of strategy, but they're absolutely essential for the economic deterrence.
Yes.
How does NDIS approach economic deterrence?
Yep. Economic.
And what role can the international partnerships play in
it? Yeah, and so, you know, economic deterrence is really about promoting free, fair, and effective market mechanisms to support a resilient defense industrial base.
Right.
Definitely requires close coordination and partnership with partners and allies, and we do that through a number of kind of bilateral and multilateral forums. But it's things like within the U.S. system, CFIUS, countering foreign investment, understanding. Not just from an M&A perspective, you know,
mergers
who's buying, exactly, mergers and acquisitions, who's buying a company and who's, you know, selling it, but then also who's investing in companies, where, what's the source of the money? Because, you know, with that that funding comes, you know, an ability to influence and access information. So we just want to make sure that as we're looking at emerging technologies and new capabilities, that we have visibility on those types of issues.
And so when you mentioned AUKUS earlier, so how is AUKUS maybe being used as a pathfinder in this? What are you trying to do differently?
Yeah, I would say AUKUS is a little bit distinct from the economic deterrence piece. It's more, as I mentioned previously, you know, really around that close collaboration around developing advanced technologies, early stage technologies, things like quantum, hypersonics, undersea warfare, electronic warfare, things of that nature.
Right. And one of the things that we're thinking about is that with NATO expanding, you're creating these new potential partnerships.
Yeah.
And some of those new NATO countries have their own capabilities, especially in some of these emerging technology areas with their great small businesses, universities.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I've spent a couple different trips out in Europe meeting with small businesses, startups, and their industry. We have a great program within DoD called Foreign Comparative Testing, where we can find ways to bring those technologies in.
Right.
You know, we'll bring them in, test them out, compare them to, you know, what we're already working on or what we're already fielding. And if it's better than what we have, let's bring it in. I mean, the goal is always to get the best, you know, capabilities to the warfighter, regardless of the source.
So as part of this strategy, one of the things that's highlighted is the effort to expand relationships with companies and industries that are not traditionally in the defense industrial base. Think the small software companies or those companies that did business with the commercial sector that are just sort of thinking about defense industry. This is really important to us because a lot of our companies in emerging technologies are exactly those, right? Not traditionally working in the DIF. So it's great to hear you're thinking about this, but the fact is DoD is not the easiest customer to work with, and a lot of companies are deterred by that. So what steps does the NDIS sort of think about to make DoD kind of a friendlier face, an easier customer to work with?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, that's a problem that we are definitely aware of, and we are taking very specific steps to try to work on that.
Yeah, I thought 20 years on the Hill, I think.
20 more years, maybe. Okay. but I would actually, you know, broaden the aperture when I say, when we think about non-traditionals, no, it's not just small businesses. It could be a medium-sized business that just has never worked with DoD before for whatever reason. So it's really just the new entrants, the folks that are just now starting that relationship and starting that journey with the Department of Defense. And there's a number of, you know, areas and ways that we're trying to tackle this. The first, within my office, actually, we have some efforts that we're putting in place to develop, you know, tools to better engage with non-traditional companies, almost like decoder ring, so to speak.
Just getting a map.
Yeah, just understanding who exactly. That's always the hardest. Who do I talk to? Right. So we're working on that, to, again, because my office, the Office of Industry Engagement, is really trying to be that bridge builder. So being able to say, okay, well, you provide these capabilities, we think that you should really talk to these people,
right,
and kind of making that match. So that's one thing that is ongoing right now, and there'll be more to follow in the coming months. I would say other things and areas that we're looking at as far as tackling this, there's a number of other barriers that prevent companies from engaging. Things like security clearances, as we mentioned before. What's the process to get them? Facility clearances. That's a huge issue for small, medium-sized businesses, SCIF access.
Right.
So there's a number of angles that we have to take to really tackle all of the issues that prevent people from effectively engaging with DoD and participating.
And so the strategy is come out. It's been public for a few months now. What's the reception
been? It's been great. So far, we engaged very heavily with industry prior to releasing the strategy to make sure that we were capturing kind of their thoughts.
A bunch of NDIA exchanges. Yes. Is great. So what do you think the results will look like?
I think looking at the number of participants in the industrial base,
is it growing?
Is it shrinking? Is it stagnant? Looking at capacity and production rates, if we see things increasing, that's a good sign. Looking at workforce levels, retention rates, and the size of companies, if they're growing, that's a good sign. Less turnover is always positive. But ultimately, the true kind of measure of our success is, are the best capabilities getting into the hands of the warfighter at speed and scale?
Right. Well, I mean, I would have to say, I've been working in this area for a while. This is the first National Defense Industrial Strategy we have. I've put out senior leader attention on these kinds of issues that you've been wrestling with your whole career. That's what drives change. So how does NDIA, how can our members help out with you pushing all of this into reality?
Yeah, I can't name names, but I've met with quite a few of your members since this was released, and solicited a ton of feedback. And I would say not just your members, but also some of the leadership of NDIA as well. And it's been phenomenal. We've got a ton of good ideas because, again, we're all looking at these challenges from different angles. And within DoD, we don't have a monopoly on good ideas. So pulling the best from all angles is definitely helpful. And I think the other areas is really just partnering with us when it comes to the resourcing aspects of this. I think across the board, we all understand the challenges. and we understand those challenges can't be tackled without resources. And so, you know, working with us and engaging with the legislative bodies to ensure that we have the funding and resources to actually implement is going to be critical. Continuing resolutions and things of that nature.
They're tough.
Right. They're tough.
So for a member company, you know, thinking about your office, you're not a program manager, you're not a program executive officer, so you're not classically a customer in that sense. So what should they think about when they're trying to engage with you, and how do they find you?
Sure. So we had a conversation yesterday, my team, and we were talking, and one thing that resonated with me, we feel like if you are coming into the building and your only meeting is with us, then we have failed. Because again, we're bridge builders. So come to us with your problems. Come to us with your challenges, and then we can partner with you.
And your ideas.
And your ideas, exactly. And we can partner with you to figure out, you know, who's the right belly button to poke.
This military service, that agency.
Exactly, this PEO, right. Here within OSD, here within this service.
Right. And Industrial Policy has a website.
Yes, businessdefense.gov.
So we're running out of time like we always do. We have time for one more question. We talked about NDIS, some of the key actions and themes. If there is just one thing you could leave the listeners with,
I would say collaboration. I think one of the things that, we recognize that this is going to be not just a whole of government effort, but almost like a whole of globe effort. Because it does take, within the U.S. system, partnership across the interagency and with the Hill.
Yeah, it's really not the whole of government, right? It's whole of the economy.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's industry, that's government.
Exactly. And then with the allies and partners, I think there's a lot of work that we need to do with them and their industry as well. So.
Well, that's great. With that, I want to thank our guest, Justin McFarlane.
Thank you for having me.
For this informative discussion. You can find the strategy online at www.businessdefense.gov/NDIS. I'm sure it's posted in lots of other places. I want to take this opportunity to highlight a few of the Emerging Technology Institute's upcoming event. Our second Emerging Technologies Conference is August 7th through 9th at the Washington Convention Center. I'm sure Mr. McFarlane will be there. I just committed him to it. We're also going to continue our ongoing monthly Technology 101 series, where we take complex topics and sort of simplify them for a layperson, as well as our other webinars and report releases. Look for our website to see all the things that we've got coming up. To register for these events and other ETI and NDI events, please visit www.ndia.org/events. Please also visit our website to look at our recently released report, Directed Energy Weapon Supply Chains, Securing the Path to the Future. We talked about that report in a previous podcast to touch on a lot of the issues that Justin mentioned today. Thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed the podcast, please don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to get all of our latest content. Please email us at etii@ndia.org with questions, comments, or ideas for our future podcast topics. Special thanks to Daniel Park and Melanie Yu for producing the podcast. See you on our next episode of Emerging Tech Horizons.